invite you to think with me a little bit tonight in this story of Jesus' Last Supper with his disciples. John tells us, now before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Now before the festival of the Passover, I invite you to underline that word before. In this clause, John indicates when this supper with his disciples took place. And so begins a difficult problem for modern interpreters. All four gospel writers say there was a last meal. Matthew, Mark, and Luke explicitly state that the Last Supper was a Passover meal. So, was the meal before the Passover, or was the meal a Passover meal? It is challenges of interpretation like this one that seem where John and the other three Gospels don't seem to agree, that the enemies of the Gospel, like Richard Dawkins, point to in order to assert the only difference between the Da Vinci Code and the Gospels is the Gospels are ancient fiction and the Da Vinci Code is modern fiction. Biblical scholar and great friend of the Gospel, F.F. Bruce, wrote that this is the thorniest problem in the New Testament. When did this supper occur? It has often been noted that if this was indeed on a Thursday evening, there isn't enough time for all the events of Jesus' various trials to take place and have the crucifixion begin around 9 a.m. on Friday morning, as Mark asserts in his gospel. Now, we could conclude, as some commentators do, that the apostles in their writings were rather loose with certain details, that their fixation with things, or the things that they are concerned about, were not the things we are. But here's another way to think of this. Is it possible that there is some practice for how they regarded calendar events, something they all knew and assumed, and this assumed local knowledge is not known by us? My father has a bill of sale, and I meant to bring it this evening, the copy of it that I have, that he had it hanging in his home. It's a poster announcing a farm auction sale. It was the sale of the estate of my great-great-great-grandfather. The date on it is 1859. On it are listed things like farm implements, how many cows and horses are for sale, things like that that would be auctioned on the appointed day. The reason I know that it's my great-great-great-grandfather is because one of the executors listed on the document is someone who I would have, or at least I knew about, as my great-great-grandfather, and he was the son of one of the executors of that sale. And so I know how I am related to this person who's listed on this document. When my father died, we had copies made of this document and given them to each of his sons and their grandchildren as well. My son has a copy now of this document in his home, and I'm sure that when my granddaughter sees this document, how will she know how is she related to that person who's on that document? It is her five greats, that's how it is, grandfather. My brothers and I, that is my generation, all know who it is. But this piece of information is in our heads. What will happen when we're gone and that piece of information is lost because it died with us? My granddaughter then will see the document but lack the detail we assumed, but it was assumed by my brothers and me, that would help unlock the mystery of how she's related to that person. We all have experience of this in our lives, don't we? The piece of information that unlocks the thing we need to know is lost to us. Now back to the question of where was the was this a last meal with the disciples? Was it a Passover meal? Now, before I'm willing to conclude that the apostles were sloppy with respect to time details like this, it might be more prudent to ask another question. Is there something they all knew and assumed, some detail of how their calendar worked, that is lost to us and would render an answer to the question? Is the problem, that is, with us and our assumptions? See, I'm more willing to live with a few ambiguities, acknowledging that I may lack something that I need to know, that I then hurry to the conclusion that these first century writers lacked accuracy or care. Now to the question, I commend a wonderful book by Colin Humphreys entitled The Mystery of the Last Supper. He puts forward a very convincing thesis that answers the problem. He argues that there's two calendars in operation among first century Jews, which impacts how they mark the festivals, the Passover among them. The Jews in Jerusalem had a different calendar than the Jews in Galilee. Now, to get to the heart of it, you have to read the whole book to get the whole thesis. But here's the nub of it. Humphrey shows that the Galilean Jews used a pre-exilic calendar. That is before the Babylon exile, before the Israelites went into exile in Babylon. And that calendar, it was the calendar that Moses would have used, consistent with how the Egyptians marked time and how their calendar worked. It was a lunar calendar, and it was a sunrise to sunrise calendar, the way in which you and I mark days. Today, April 17th began at 12 midnight, you know, just passed, and it goes till 12 midnight tonight. So it was marked the same way that we do. That's how the Jews in Galilee marked time. The Jerusalem Jews, however, and they used what they called the official calendar, used a post-exilic calendar consistent with the way the Babylonians had their calendar worked. Now, that's the place where they were in exile, and so they borrowed that practice when they came back to the land of Israel. It was also a lunar calendar, and it was a sunset. They marked days from sunset to sunset. The Passover was observed always on the 14th day of the Jewish month of Nisan. According to the Galilean calendar, the date for the Passover in the year 33 AD, which is the year, most likely the year that Jesus would have been crucified, was from sunrise to sunrise on Wednesday, April the 1st. And according to the official Jerusalem calendar, it was from sunset Thursday to Friday, sunset the next day. All of that to say this, that it is most likely that he believes that Jesus then and his disciples celebrated Passover according to the pre-exilic calendar, that they'd come to Jerusalem, that what they had done on Wednesday is that they had observed Passover as they would have if they were in Galilee, and that that's the meal that they had that evening. This means that the meal that Jesus had with his disciples was indeed a Passover meal and occurred on Wednesday evening, which resolves all those difficulties about how much time it needed from when the supper took place to when he was crucified for all of the trials to take place. So it was a Wednesday evening. It is interesting, although we do celebrate it on Thursday, it is interesting to note how John speaks of the Passover. He speaks of it as the Passover of the Jews. When John says the Jews, he typically means the Jewish leadership. Humphrey says that John notes it this way specifically to tell his readers which calendar he's referring to. Humphrey's solution, you see, does solve the apparent discrepancy between John and the other gospel writers. It's a well-researched scholarly proposal, and there's much to commend. But the point I want to make to you about all that is this. It means for certain that Jesus' crucifixion was on Friday. First of all, that the Passover that Jesus would have observed with his Jews was on the exact day of the one that Moses, in other words, it's to the exact date of the one that was instituted by Moses. The second thing is this, that he would have been crucified on Friday, and as he was crucified, we are told in the gospel accounts that at 3:00 in the afternoon on Friday, he uttered this cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? About that time. We're also told that if you put the gospel letters together, that there's, in quick succession, he uttered three other things. He said, I thirst, it is finished. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. And then he breathed his last. It's also at 3 in the afternoon that the lambs would be slaughtered for the official Passover. 3:00, same time. The gospel writers all point that this was the day of preparation. This was when the lambs, that is when the crucifixion took place. This is when the lambs were sacrificed for the celebration of Passover that evening. Jesus' death coincides with the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. This is no coincidence or accident. God is acting deliberately here. John the Apostle had been a disciple of John the Baptist. Near the beginning of the Apostle John's gospel, he recalls how John the Baptist introduced him to Jesus. As he watched Jesus walk by, he exclaimed, look, here is the Lamb of God. The Apostle Paul makes the connection between the Passover lamb and Jesus writing, "For our Paschal lamb, Christ, has been sacrificed." The Apostle Peter concurs, "You know that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your ancestors, not with perishable things like silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without defect or blemish." And then, of course, in the Revelation of John, he sees the heavenly throne room where the hymn of praise thunders, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slaughtered." I remind you of how the disciples, early in their ministry with Jesus, had rejected the teaching that the Messiah would die. It was after the resurrection that he connects the dots for these disciples with the Old Testament scriptures, showing that all of this must take place. Only Jesus carries this knowledge as he sits down at this Passover meal with his disciples. Only Jesus apprehends what agony is coming when he raises the cup and says, "This is the new covenant in my blood." Let me put it to you this way. For Jesus, these events aren't mere symbols. He knows that he will actually bear that to which the sacrifice of countless lambs over the centuries of Passovers could only point. Imagine then what is in Jesus' mind by way of anticipation as he celebrates this Passover with his disciples. John puts it so very simply. Jesus knew that his hour had come. Now, it's quite an understatement. But then again, could words possibly capture the immensity of what he will bear for our sakes? Jesus knew that his hour had come. Now, what does John mean by his hour? The word hour is used as a euphemism for the culminating moment or the most revealing time. We sometimes speak of someone's shining hour. In our fast-paced age of short attention spans, we reduce that time of fame. Instead, we speak of 15 minutes of fame. But what is John indicating by his hour? Well, the first instance of this notion of Jesus' hour in John's gospel occurs at that wedding in Cana of Galilee where Jesus performed his first miracle. When Mary, his mother, said to Jesus and asked him to do something about the diminishing supply of wine, this is what Jesus said to her. "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." Apparently, Jesus' hour is not seen in the performance of miracles. As wonderful and as beneficial and as helpful as these miracles were in people's lives through the course of his life, this is not his hour. Jesus did not come primarily for this purpose. The next instance is when Jesus is in conversation with the woman at the well. He says, "The hour is coming and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father seeks such as these to worship him." He says something very similar in the aftermath of his healing of the lame man at the pool of Bethesda. "Very truly, I tell you, the hour is coming and is now here, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live." Now, you can hear in those sayings both that the hour is somehow here, but something about it is not yet. He is here, but the fullness of the hour hasn't come. His ministry of healing and teaching has a role to play, but it is not the fullness of his hour. The opposition to Jesus grows to the point that the Pharisees sent temple police one day to arrest him. But in the end, they couldn't do it because of the crowds. John says, "Then they tried to arrest him, but no one laid hands on him because his hour had not yet come." John says something greater was going on here than immediately meets the eye. The hand of God is moving events to a culmination that has not yet arrived. A similar incident occurs in the temple treasury. After a difficult exchange between Jesus and the Pharisees, he speaks these words while he was teaching in the treasury to the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. The next reference to his hour is during Holy Week, likely on Tuesday evening. Some Greeks, or Tuesday afternoon, some Greeks had come to Jesus during the Passover. Likely, or come to Jerusalem during the Passover, they want to see Jesus. Likely, what these people are known as what were called God-fearers, people who were interested in the monotheism and the benefits that Judaism offered, but who had not taken the ritual requirements, meaning circumcision. They asked to meet with Jesus, and in response to their request, Jesus answered, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Verily, truly, I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single seed. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." You can see what Jesus thinks his hour means. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, if it dies, it bears much fruit. The thought is deeply troubling for Jesus, because immediately after that, we are told that there's turmoil in his heart and mind that immediately follows. And he says this, "Now my soul is troubled. And what should I say? Father, save me from this hour. Father, glorify your name." The last two references Jesus makes to this hour are during the last meal with his disciples. "The hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each one to his home, and you will leave me alone. Yet I'm not alone, because the Father is with me." And then shortly after that, in that prayer that he offered before they went out to the Mount of Olives, a prayer that he offered for his disciples, for himself, and for those who would believe in me through their word, meaning us. After Jesus had spoken these words, he looked up to heaven and said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son so that the Son may glorify you." You see, clearly, his hour are the events that are about to unfold. When John introduces this last meal by saying Jesus knew that his hour had come, the hour refers to the extraordinary nature of the events now to be described in his arrest, trials, conviction, and crucifixion. Despite the great importance of his teaching, his example, and his works of compassion and power, none of these was central to his mission. None of these are described as his hour. What dominated his mind was not the living of his life, but the giving of his life. This final self-sacrifice was his hour for which he has come into the world. And the four evangelists who bear witness to him in the Gospels show that they understood this by the disproportionate amount of space which they give to the story of his last few days on earth, his death and resurrection. Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. As we respond,